Hello, this is Matt Hale bringing you another edition of the Art Monthly Talk Show. This programme is based on two written pieces from the October 2022 edition of Art Monthly, which is number 460. Can you believe we have made 460 magazines now, which I suppose is possible if you start in 1976. Now, there are links between the two pieces, which I hope we will endeavour to reveal. But the piece we will discuss first is a lead review. That means it's the first review in a run of reviews in the magazine. And it's by Ellen Mara de Wachter. Now, Ellen, correct me. Did I say your last name correctly?
Wachter. Pretty good. Yeah, it was pretty good.
W-A-C-H-T-E-R, listeners. And it's about Carolee Schneeman's retrospective Body Politics, which is currently at the Barbican Main Gallery in London until the 8th of January 2023. The second piece we'll discuss is a feature by Dave Beach, which is based around artist Mariam Jaffery's Independence Days and deals with photography and colonialism and more. Welcome to both my guests, Dave and Ellen.
Thank you.
Ellen, hello. You live in London. We were just saying you live in East London, I think, and you're an arts and culture writer. That's what I understand. But you've written a book as well, and probably others, but one called Co-Art, Artists on Creative Collaboration, published by Fiden, which explores phenomenon of collaboration in the visual arts and its potential in society at large. Did I do that okay?
Yeah, that's all true.
Yeah. I mean, you may want to say you do other things or promote something else you're doing currently, which you're very welcome to do.
Yeah, I mean, the Carolee Schneeman review kind of fits into a project that I've been working on, which is a book that I've finished writing the manuscript of, and it's with my editor at the moment, around the use of food as a material in art. And it runs between 1960 and 2000. And so Carolee's Meat Joy is one of the chapters in the book. So I was really interested in seeing what would happen with her first major retrospective in the UK. So I really wanted to look at it kind of, I'd spent so much time looking specifically at Meat Joy that I wanted to see what, actually, first of all, see a lot of the works, which I'd only ever read about and which had never been shown in this country, and then see what the curators would do with a kind of telling of her whole life and oeuvre.
Which is not an easy thing to do. Yeah. I just suddenly thought of another food work by someone I loved called Helen Chadwick.
Yes, yeah.
Who did a huge food piece in the ICA, which in the end, I think, closed the ICA because of the way it rotted and blew up eventually.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a lot of smells in my book as well as tastes.
Do they come as sort of little bits of litmus paper or something that you can...
No, you have to use your imagination. You have to, I mean, I really encourage people to kind of tap into their sensory, archive. And we all have loads of experience with foods and smells. So I encourage people to reimagine, you know, what it was like.
Well, that sounds like a good book. I look forward to seeing it and reading it. We could talk about that for ages, I'm sure, just riffing. But Dave, the second piece we'll discuss, as I said, was with Dave Beach. And Dave is an artist and reader in art and Marxism at Chelsea College of Art, but fundamentally an artist. I think I should underline that. And Dave, I think you're working currently for a little while now with montage. Is that correct? Yes.
Yeah, I used to work in the collective Free, with Mel Jordan and Andy Hewitt, and then that split up around about 2017, and I've been working as a solo artist since then, making photo montages.
Yeah, didn't you have a show in Exeter Phoenix that I saw, I didn't see it, to be honest. I saw it online.
Nobody saw it because it was during lockdown. So,
it's funny because I know that space. They advertise in Art Monthly, and I know Matt who works there and stuff, and it's a really good thing. And I don't actually think I knew the show was on, for my sins.
Yeah, well, Matt said to me, you know, you can put the show on now, but the building will be closed. There'll be nobody allowed in. Or we can wait for another time. And I said, I'd really love to do the show now.
Yeah.
And no one can see it. That would be the perfect situation for me.
It's on your website,
it's all very new to me. So I wanted to experiment with a space but not have the pressure of lots of people coming along telling me how rubbish I am.
Well, that was very clever. And if you have a slightly nervous propensity to audiences. Anyway, let's begin by discussing Carolee Schneeman's body politics. And obviously, it's your ball, really. But I went yesterday to see the show and I was actually quite moved by it, which I don't mean that to sound silly and romantic, but I just thought her strength of continuing to fight against, you know, the sort of patriarchy, as I think she would call it, was really quite amazing, really. Will you just help listeners and I and everybody sort of know more about her, really? Because I think you do say that you think it's a very important show. I was going to say, actually, I often try and do this. When you go to the end of people's pieces, they often, the way they end is often a really quite good way of beginning to keep our listeners with us. And it says, you wrote, until a few years before her death, Schneeman's work was largely ignored by institutions, ill-equipped to deal with performance and archive, by dealers unsure of how to sell it, and by a society squeamish about bodies. She transmuted that rejection into energy, which I think is fantastic and really well put. Never compromising to make her work more commercially or culturally viable, Schneeman's persistence is vital, especially now when censorship chokes culture on so many fronts, when the fear of getting something wrong often means nothing gets done at all. Dave has just given us a fine example of keeping going despite possibilities of rejection. There you are, there's one there. But that was a great ending to your review, I thought. So you can go back to the beginning now.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. yeah, I mean, the beginning is, I guess, when she was born, which was 1939 in Pennsylvania. And she, I mean, from a very early age, she was an artist. And in fact, I went yesterday to see the show at Hales Gallery, which is her dealer gallery here in London, which shows paintings and I guess sketches and things that she made when she was a teenager. So 1955, 56, 57, there's one from 59, but that's as late as that show goes. And just to see these works that she made as a 16-year-old, it's the only word for it is energy. And like, you know, they're she's completely influenced by Cézanne. She's also rejecting the kind of patriarchal art history and trying to find her own way. And she just throughout her life, she seemed to have this like indomitable body force, you know, that she's just pure kind of energy and you know, blood and guts and kind of sensuality. And it never goes away and she never kind of compromises that. And that's what I find completely radical about her practice, as well as the fact that throughout her life she writes. And she's such a good writer. She's funny, she's sharp, she's pithy. I mean, just, you know, if you want to read something that's going to poke you up the bum, just read some of her writing, because it really wakes you up. It's sort of, she has this quality of just reducing a whole complex problem into one phrase that makes you understand it viscerally as well as intellectually. I think that's where it begins, with this young woman who grows up and her father was a doctor, and she grew up in kind of rural Pennsylvania. And she, in some of my research, I was interested in, you know, why she was interested in working with carcasses of animals. And she tells this anecdote of when she was a young woman being a chicken farmer, and every Friday night she had to kind of slaughter, I think something like 20 or whatever number of chickens. And she gives this description of killing them and her pleasure at sort of handling the carcasses and, you know, appreciating this life that is now gone. And she's extremely sort of graphic. And she says she loved to kind of pull out the tiny eggs that were still warm from the chickens she just slaughtered and things like that. So she's never afraid of really telling it as it is, in terms of the deep kind of visceral engagement with the world around her and the world within her, you know, her own body. And, you know, she kind of goes to art school and then gets kicked out of art school because she's painting nude self-portraits, and that's not acceptable for a woman to do at the time. She gets involved in, when she moves to New York, she gets involved with different artists working around Judson Dance Theater, and then becomes part of Judson Dance Theater, and then sort of moves away from that, and then works in Europe, and she moves around a fair amount within the art world, but always kind of a singular figure who's taking a lot of risks. So yeah, I mean, for me, what's amazing is that she never self-censored. And I think that is, you know, as a writer, every sentence I write gets rewritten multiple times. And for me, that's process. And that's kind of, that's what I enjoy doing, is finding a better way to say something each time. But you can also see that, an aspect of that, as being self-censorship, because I write something that comes out a bit garbled, and I think, well, that's not good enough, so I'll just cut it and redo it. So is that self-censorship or is that craft? I don't know. It's a fine line sometimes. And I don't know. She managed to tread that line really well by continuing to take risks, but also continuing to refine her message and refine what she was doing.
Yeah, I was going to say, she probably does it over a lifetime, the editing that you're talking about doing in a text, and gradually. Just out of interest, you talk about her writing. Where does that appear? I mean, how, in The Barbican, there's quite a lot of her handwriting notes towards performances and things.
There's a few.
Are you talking about diaries, or what are you talking about?
All kinds of different places. I mean, she was a contributor to several magazines and art journals throughout her life. So there's those places, but they're more difficult to access. You'd have to go to libraries and archives. There's a book called More Than Meat Joy, where she collects her writings. And so that's a really important text. And I forget exactly when it came out, maybe late 80s, or I don't remember the date. But then I think it was reissued more recently. So it's a big book, thick, horizontal format, where there's actually a lot of images, but many of her texts, and among which is the entire score for Meat Joy, which is like a 12-page score. So Meat Joy wasn't just this frolic with carcasses. It was like a very, very structured, very refined score for her performers, which included also text. And there's voiceovers in the Meat Joy performance. That there's one that is a composite of her diaries, but also, she was learning French at the time, so things from instruction books on how to learn French, and then other bits of music and lyrics and things. So but that's all kind of available in the score.
So it sounds almost like a kind of choreography. So she
absolutely,
because listeners won't, and I wasn't particularly familiar with exactly what she did. She was in dance. She did what was called dance groups, collaborations of, I mean, I know it's quite unconventional dance, as we've been seeing then, but she was in sort of collaborating with other people in a dance groups. And then it developed into her being more directing, and, you know, being the artist who people then were, I mean, how did she collaborate? How much input from others did she allow into her work? I mean, Dave, you've collaborated, as you said, with Free. So I was going to mention Free, but you did it for me. I think it is quite interesting thing, because for a lot of artists, it's something they wouldn't do, you know, just collaborating, because it's almost like it contradicts the idea of I am an artist. But actually, you can see with Schliemann, it's incredibly important that use or working with others. I'm not asking anyone this question. I'm just sort of stating something obvious, really. But I'm quite interested in that aspect of forming work and how she did it, really.
It's in some disciplines, it's much more customary to work with others. So musicians work together.
Yes.
And filmmakers work in sometimes quite large teams, but even independent filmmakers will work in small teams. Actors usually need to work with other actors in order to
theater,
you know, have dialogue. And it's unusual to work alone as an actor, and that's remarkable when somebody does. Depending on if you do a certain kind of practice, then you kind of move closer or further away from this custom of working with others. And that, so in a, when we say that artists maybe turn their back on collaboration, it's certain kinds of artists who have a, an attachment to certain kinds of artistic practice. Yeah. And there are lots of artists, you know, someone like Robert Morris, for instance, who's also associated with dance, and through dance, in a sense, started to kind of rethink how sculpture might be understood more socially rather than as something that an individual produces on their own in a studio.
The thing is,
when you start to work with these other kinds of disciplines, then you can start to question that propensity for artists to work alone.
Yes, no, it's just that she apparently said all her life that she was a painter. Which was a kind of contradiction, I thought, in this sense, that she's sort of saying, well, I'm an individual. But I think it was more to just, perhaps it was something that she just was expanding painting.
Yeah, I think it's that.
Talk about her early work, Ellen, that's quite interesting, because she talked about that as being, didn't she, some sort of, well, performance, or actually the work that you look at it is quite very involved with the body and movement.
Yeah, I think that's right. She did maintain throughout her life that she was a painter first and foremost. And I think that has to do with her early ideas around painting, which was that she wanted to paint time and space. So not just a picture, you know, she wanted to bring the nude, she said, off the canvas. And that's where her performance work came in terms of enacting bodily movement and imagery in space with bodies. And then she developed what she called kinetic theater, which then sort of led to her work with Judson Dance Theater. And I think rather than dance per se, I think she would have said it was performance, which maybe like she would consider like a broader term than simply dance.
Actually
at the show, it was interesting because in my research, I hadn't come across this idea that she was a founding member of Judson Dance Theater, and yet they said it on one of the wall captions, and I was like, okay, that's a slightly different narrative than the one that I've picked up through my reading. So I just wasn't sure where that came from specifically, and she was definitely involved from early on with Judson Dance Theater, but I wasn't aware that she'd been a founding member. Cool. So that was maybe a sort of new bit of information from the exhibition. And I mean, this question around, you know, collaborating and not collaborating, I mean, for me, it's really important to think about even artists who author work in a kind of under just one name as part of sort of art worlds. You know, this idea from Howard Becker, the sociologist, who describes the ways in which every single artwork that reaches us is the product of its own art world. And that includes not just the person who made it, but also all the attendant kind of jobs that are enabling it. So, you know, if it's a painter, the people who made the paints, the people who made the brushes, who made the canvases, who delivered those things, but also, you know, the families who cook for the artists who help them, you know, live their lives, or the people who sell their work for them, or the writers who write about it, or the teachers
or the
who
teach
about it. The what?
The cats.
The cats who kiss them, exactly. Get kissed by them, we don't really know.
I'd love to talk about the cats a little bit, because they do appear in a few things, particularly the film, which I think we should all talk about, Fuses.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a great film, which I thought from what I was read about it briefly before was it was pornographic, but I actually didn't think it was. It was a very elegant film about lovemaking. And the treatment of the film was amazing. But there was this other film she made where she's kissing her cat, like snogging her cat, which I did find, I have to say, I mean, I'm obviously very prudish, but I found it quite hard to look at it for long, because it just revolted me, the idea of this. But she was very involved with her cats, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that the way you've just described Fuses, that's where the painter comes in. I mean, that's what she was doing to that film stock, was painting it and bleaching it and you know, distressing it in lots of different ways.
Yeah, there's a marvelous list. It says the film was cut, spliced, scratched, layered, baked in the oven, printed over, dipped in acid, exposed to the sun, rain, and lightning, which I thought was incredible, and actually does change the film totally from just being a film of two people making love or something. It's totally other thing.
Yeah, and it's two people making love over 3 years, by the way, in short segments, because she could only film short. I forget if it's 30 seconds or what segments, you know. And also, not only that, but it's two people making love and Kitch the cat, because there's three protagonists in it, you know, Kitch the cat, which like was never her cat. She didn't want that ownership kind of an animal. So it was always Kitch the cat. And I realized rereading my review that I say her cat. And I was like, should I have said Kitch? Should I have said the, should I have named Kitch the cat?
Yeah. But as an equal.
Totally, yeah. And I mean, she was really interested in the poetry of Michael McClure, who wrote about meat, who I think his collection was called Meat Bodies. And his theory was like, we're all meat bags, and that there's an equivalence between all beasts, you know, there's a bestial quality to all living beings. And that was something that really appealed to her. And goes back to this idea that I was saying about when she was slaughtering chickens and her understanding of the body, thanks to her father's, you know, being a doctor and helping her understand how bodies were things to contend with, you know, not just things we don't talk about. But kissing the cat is a challenging work. Like it's called Infinity Kisses, the main work that's at the Barbican. And
yeah.
It's challenging. Yeah,
I found it most challenging. It's weird. But listen, we should also talk. You mentioned it part of your review very interestingly. I thought that not a bad criticism, but there was an element of criticism you had with the curate. It was curated and separated out the politics, as in her political works, which involved clearly political issues or her political position on things, and body. I mean, you say it better than me, but her work, which they sort of separated out her personal work or her body work from. But whereas you said that actually they were making a false separation, because some things were made at the same time as other things, and then they put them at the end as if they were made later. Or you know, talk about that, because politics for me is threaded throughout her work.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to a lot of different things, one of which is the architecture of the Barbican galleries and the way that you have this upstairs suite of galleries that are like cubicles, you know, which are really well suited to historic and archival presentations of, like, you know, telling a life or telling the trajectory of a movement or something like that. And then the downstairs, like triple height kind of extravaganza spaces, which are suited to like big sculpture or movement or installations. So I can empathize with the curatorial choice to kind of put Viet Flakes, which was the work I talk about, which was made very early on, downstairs, because it's you know, you have to stand back from it and watch it. And then there's other video installations in that same area. And then upstairs, you have a room dedicated to a Meat Joy, and you have a room dedicated to Fuses, which is presented. I forget if there's a curtain, but it's definitely.
No, there isn't, but it is almost as if there's a man who sits at the entrance
saying, careful here.
Like he's going to tell you to watch out. Something might happen bad to you if you go in there, kind of thing, or to stop children going. I don't know. It does feel a bit censored.
I think it's kind of, it's caution around sort of a soft form of censorship there. Yeah, definitely. The thing is that, you know, she never thought of Meat Joy as just a body thing. Although I think Meat Joy, you know, it gets sort of unfortunately reduced to this thing that is this like short sequence in it, which is about the kind of sort of writhing around with the carcasses and the meat and the blood and so on. And then comes paint. But that was only part of the whole 40-minute performance. But, you know, she was influenced by McClure's kind of poetry around meat. bags, you know, us being meat bags, as well as, you know, she said, you know, butcher shops in Paris. And she was in Paris where, when she kind of was right before presenting it, because Jean-Jacques Lebel invited her to be part of the Festival of Free Expression in 1964. And so she came over and she started recording the sounds of the street vendors through her window in the hotel. So it was the street market and butchers were like selling their meat. And so there's this aspect of meat, of course, to meat joy. But for me, it's really important, like, to stress the joy. It's meat joy. It's not meat joy. It's meat joy. I don't know if you can tell the difference in the accent.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's like, it's about joy. And it, ultimately, she thought of it as a way of kind of enacting a mutual pleasure, you know, and egalitarian pleasure between men and women and actually all involved. And, you know, the thing with the meat poetry or the meat kind of metaphysics really is that it didn't matter if you were male or female or animal or human or whatever, we were all meat bags and we all could kind of share that in common. And all of that she put at the service of solving the conscience of the guilty culture because of the war in Vietnam. I mean, that was what that work was about for her. And so for me to say, okay, well, it's about performance, it's about using the body, it's about introducing this unusual material that is meat, that's true. But what's really interesting is that she put that at the service of an anti-war kind of stance. I just felt like that, separating that out on the top floor and then downstairs coming to the war, the work that could be said to be like explicitly about the war in Vietnam because it has the word Viet in it, you know, is just a kind of, it's a missed opportunity to make it, you know, all about what it was really about for her, which was a complex of things.
So Ellen, just to try and make a crossover to Dave's piece, I'm just thinking, Dave, about the way that, well, there's the photographic work in your feature. There's a sort of well, not well. There's gridded works in Carolee Scheemann's work where she actually collects menstrual spots on paper after a comment, disparaging comment made by a boyfriend, I think, but in grids, in rows. So there's almost like a kind of system. Now, I know they're not photographs, they're not images, but there is a kind of also in your piece about Maram Jaffery, I imagine, and I haven't seen the book, so it's obviously, I may be wrong, but there's lots of photographs which are quite similar type of photographs to each other presented, and the meaning is partly out of the sort of quantity and similarity. And that's the same sort of thing with Carolee's. She collects this regular spotting of blood and just presents it. So its force is in its presentation and repetition to a degree. And so that's my weak link anyway. But will you bring us on to your feature about Maryam Jaffery's artist's photo book, Independence Days, and just tell us a little bit about how she got to make the book. That would be a good start, I think.
Yeah, sure. So Maryam Jaffery's Independence Days is a book that's based on 10 years of archival work. The artist visited photo archives in numerous countries, and some of them are official archives, so that, you know, like the state archives or the equivalent of state archives, and some of them are very private archives, personal archives, like, you know, the photographs collected by a particular family or something like that, or the photographic archive of a photographer. And what she did was she went to over 40 archives. In fact, I think it's 41.
Right.
And she selected from that images of Independence Days. So images of ceremonies, celebrations, parties, official signings and flags being lowered and flags being raised and all of those kinds of things. So every photograph that she could find that had this relationship to a political transition from, at least in a formal sense, from colonialism to post-colonialism, or from what we might say from colonialism to independence. But looking at the photo, we might not necessarily see that independence. What we might see is the stamp of the imperial power on the scene that we're looking at itself, because they're so similar, even though they're in such different places.
Yeah, it was that similarity, I suppose, I was thinking about. Just to be really basic, and I even asked my partner if I should ask this question before, but can we just say what we mean by colonialism? Because you're talking about sort of an event and events which we don't do colonialism anymore. But, you know, I know everyone talks about it, but I'm just sometimes worried that we use things and then we're not, I'm thinking, actually, do I really know what that means? Can you help us with that?
Okay, so in Mariam Jeffrey's project, I think we're dealing with two conceptions of colonialism. And we can talk about these in a kind of like a literal sense and a more extended sense. So the literal sense is when a nation has a colony. In other words, it has a territory that is not regarded as its home territory, but it controls and it maybe settles. That you have settlers in colonial territories, and when you no longer have that colony, then in one sense you could call that a post-colonial situation, and in one sense we would say that the period of colonialism has now ended, insofar as most of what we thought of in the 19th and 20th centuries being colonial powers no longer have those colonies. Those colonies have been made independent or have been given political autonomy. But the reason that we have a second definition of colonialism is because the power relations between the former colonies and the former colonial powers has not been redressed. So we have a continuation of colonialism after the colonies have been made independent, either granted independence, if we could think about it as granting independence, or we can think about it as going through a liberation struggle in which you win independence. But in either case, what has resulted is something like a kind of modified colonialism, or a colonialism that can, in a certain literal sense, deny itself. Say, we're not colonial anymore because, and point to various kinds of independence and freedom and political autonomy, regardless of the fact that economically and politically and socially and culturally, those relations of dependence and relations of dominance and so forth are still in place in most cases.
And are they in place, like, when the photographs of these ceremonies of when independence was declared, I think you talk about the kind of people that are appearing in those, and I think you describe them, I can't remember the exact words, but basically they're a certain kind of people who are receiving the power once it's handed back, and they are kind of people influenced by those that are giving it back, and that's where this kind of decolonization in a way hasn't quite happened as openly as it should, or as freely as it should. This collection of photos about that failure in some way?
I think that Jeffrey is particularly concerned with certain aspects of that transition and the transmission of power from one power to another. There are essays by three different people in the book. So there's Nina Tabasomi, Ariella Aisha Azule, and Paul O'Neill. And Azule draws your attention to a particular legacy of this of these Independence Days, which where she says, you know, there were women involved in the independence movements, but these women were not handed the power at this during these independence ceremonies. So there's a sense in which there's a specificity to who gets to be associated with independence and who doesn't get to be associated with independence, and that kind of betrayal of the women in independence struggles is really pronounced in this visual record. What's not shown in the visual record, obviously, is the struggle itself. And so we need somebody like Azule to point out that women in colonized countries were active in the independence movements, but were then not included in the new regimes.
So the photographs show an absence, do they, of women, for instance?
Well, not an absence of women. Women are present, but they have a particular role. As supporters, as family members, as wives, as part of a kind of, in a sense, a sort of the convivial aspect. So women from colonized countries and women from colonial powers will greet each other at airports, for instance, in these photographs. So they have a role to play, but it's a secondary role. They're not obviously signing the independence agreements or anything like that. So there's a clear sort of handing of power over an elite, over from one elite to another elite.
So these photographs are kind of like, by their mass and grouping, they present, they like evidence of what you're describing, which, because I'm quite interested in the, you make a connection between the way that Jaffrey presents these photographs as being more like a conceptual art presentation of photography. I'm quite interested in the difference between that, her presentation, and these photographs, which are they re-photographs of the originals that she's taken? I mean, they're not taken by her, are they? That she's presented
right.
her work, which is quite interesting.
The re-photographing is not like a sort of Sherry Levine re-photographing. The re-photographing is a commercial transaction. So in some cases, the archives themselves employ someone to re-photograph and she just pays them the fee. Or maybe they subcontract, maybe they don't have anybody there. And sometimes maybe she has to find someone who will be doing the re-photographing for her. And it's a commercial transaction from her point of view. And it's a technical job from the photographer's point of view. So they just need to photograph it as best they can. And so there is a kind of like a kind of choreographed activity taking place here that she's scripting a process in order to assemble this, in a sense, this new archive, which ends up as a book. So it is a book, and that's what I write about. But she has these photographs and she's exhibited them in galleries. So there is this kind of actual archive, and I'm assuming that she keeps them under archival conditions in boxes.
But it's also kind of reclaiming. In a sense, it feels a bit like she's reclaiming these images. It's all as I mean, is it important that she's a woman and she is reclaiming them? Perhaps her power is with, she has the power over how they're seen, for instance, and the texts are presented to explain what they are, but somewhere slightly separate in the book, and that's a decision by her as well. Again,
it is, and what's extraordinary about it? So you talked about the relationship between this project and maybe like conceptual uses of photography. What would be more typical in a kind of classic conceptual use of photography is that the captions are shown alongside the images. But in this case, the captions are completely separate physically. So it's effectively a book of photographs, and page after page, you see these constellations of photographs with no indication of where they're from, who they're of, when they were taken or anything like that, but with titles that she's given to little kind of chapters, if you like. So her organizing of the images is paramount there. But then there's a kind of supplement to the book which slides into the book, and you can take that out, and then you can identify the date and the place and the event of each photograph. But it's physically separate, which is I think makes it different from a kind of classic conceptual use of photography, and also maybe makes it kind of less Brechtian or less Benjaminian in that sense that they don't have, that it's not about establishing this relationship between the photographic image and the caption. It weakens that link.
Yes. You I think you mentioned other conceptual or conceptual photography projects, Atlas, particularly by Gerhard Richter, which is a collection, isn't it? A mass collection of photographs, which I think are presented, I think, without any kind of apparent reason for why they're put together at all, which so it's very, very visual and very kind of open to interpretation, but just sort of factually laid out in grids, I think, when installed. I was quite interested in that, in this big difference between, you know, what you think of as documentary photography, which always comes with text and analysis, or isn't it?
Absolutely. And we do get the facts. We just get them in an unusual order or an unusual kind of relationship there's a sense in which I think Jeffrey imagines that part of the power of these images is not so much in each individual image, but is in the way that they repeat certain patterns. So if you have a series of images which are all of, you know, dignitaries in cars driving down streets with people lining the streets, and you see that over and over again, in different countries, in different years, in different decades, then maybe there's a kind of a sort of social science, anthropological impulse where we say, I can see something's happening here, which is not just a spontaneous event where, you know, these people in this particular place were so enthused by the independence of their country that they came out on the street spontaneously. When you see it happening over decades in different places, then you start to maybe have this inkling that there's something else going on there. And I think that that's the primary effect of seeing the images on the page. And in a sense, that ends up being confirmed when you see the text, the very small amounts of information that you get in the text, which says that these were in different places and at different times.
Ellen, did you want to ask any questions? I have got others, but I thought you have been
slightly quiet. I should say I haven't seen the book either, but I've seen the illustrations that are in the magazine. But what I found really interesting and came out in your essay was about how I actually hadn't realized that the index was a separate sort of piece of publication. But what I find interesting is the way the way she's organized these images and presented them sort of leaves so much out, and it leaves out, as you said just now, I think somehow like this sort of idea of the liberation struggle being more than just this polished ritual that gets repeated. And for me, that kind of links back to Carolee Schneemann in the sense that she was interested in liberation through the body, and that's why she did performance, and that's why she showed her body and worked with her body and the bodies of others. And that this is a kind of primary way in which people who are disempowered can enact a liberation. You know, it's not through official state kind of performances, but it's through a kind of daily practice, or which are, you know, and the women on the tarmac are I would say not secondary. It's such images that make us believe they are secondary, and that basically, you know, they're primary because they have not least because they've given birth to all these people, you know. And so I find the project really interesting. It almost feels like, I mean, you, Dave, you kind of draw it into kind of contemporary social media imagery and the way that that acquires significance through kind of collective approval or collective sharing or whatever. And I think, you know, it almost feels somehow like Maryam Jaffery is like trolling history by leaving out all the context and by just showing this sort of stark collection of, really, when we look at them, they're sort of vaguely absurd. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, mise en scène, which always looks really stiff. And I love, I mean, the one I recognize because I am Belgian is Patrice Lumumba signing Congo, and it's the one there, and this guy next to him, who I think was the I don't know, prime minister of Belgium or somebody, he's kind of taken off his glasses and his eyebrows are raised into these like commas, you know, and it's almost like a burlesque sort of scene, you know, and it's difficult to kind of bring in a comic aspect because it's so, these documents are evidence of such trauma and such abuse that continues to today, you know, as you said. But there is something about biting back, I think, about this project and not allowing these images the power they purport to have.
Yeah, I think that what links Jaffery's project with Schneeman's project is also the thing that separates them, and I think that what is what you've just referred to there is the kind of the choreography of the scene that is photographed, and I think that for Jaffery, that the very fact that we can see this choreography in action puts a question mark over the authenticity of the event. And I think that the choreography in Schneeman's work does the opposite. Mm. And so I think that the choreography, in a sense, is part of what gives the body meaning. Mm-hmm. Because the body is not just, I mean, there's a kind of crossover, isn't there, between the body as subject and the body as object, which is, you know, so meet joy is, in a sense, a combination of object and subject, meet and joy. Mm-hmm. But it's also, in a sense, a way of bringing the rationality, thought, feelings, emotions, propositionality, and so on and so forth into so which then, in a sense, makes the gives the meat a certain kind of life and direction. So the choreography aspect of it is, I think, an open question. I don't think that it is necessarily the thing that cast doubt on whether these photographs actually do represent a real moment of independence. I think that there's a presumption in the way that this is called into question, which is that because the choreography is common across different colonial countries, that therefore it must be coming from the imperial powers. Because that's the only thing that's common, and so therefore it becomes something that's imposed on it. Mm-hmm. And there is an element of truth in that, but I think that the choreography is also part of having a ceremony, of having a kind of choreography is something that is common not only to political events, but also to religious events and to other kinds of maybe more vernacular kinds of events, you know, ceremonies and rituals and so on and so forth all require choreography. And I think that is in a sense, so we could maybe then use Schneemann as a way of rethinking what we're looking at when we see these choreographed events in these photographs, maybe as something more joyful, less, I don't know, imposed, less as a kind of stifling of the local culture or something like that.
That's interesting, because actually Carolee did do a lot of choreographic, there's writing where she's describing exactly what the event, the performance will have. I mean, it's clearly not detail, but it is interesting that she did choreograph, didn't she? But what then appears to be perhaps completely spontaneous kind of action. It's weird combination, maybe. But it's an interesting link, Dave, between the choreography of the colonial ceremony.
It makes me think about, this phrase that Carolee Schneemann sort of repeated throughout her life and used in slightly different ways. But at first it was about the series of works she made, her first kind of photographic series where she used her own body, called I/Body. And she said, I am both the image and the image maker. And that was something that was not countenanced by the critics at the time, and it was really problematic. And she appeared nude in it, and she appeared in what might have been to some people provocative poses and so on, with snakes on her chest and so on. And so, but it was this idea that she was both image and image maker, and fully taking the power of the creation of the image and appearing and performing within it, or being it, and it's interesting what you say, Dave, about that we don't always know to what extent the independence gainers, let's say, were involved in choreographing these images, but later in her life, she came back to this idea of image and image maker. And when her work was subject to censorship, she said, the problem is that the censors cannot distinguish between the image and the image maker. So they kind of conflate the two and therefore censor it. Whereas, the ability to distinguish might have allowed it to go through as art rather than as the work of a kind of dissolute woman or something like that, but yeah, image maker as kind of claiming the power for the images of yourself is interesting. And
There's an important question of time there as well, isn't there? Because I remember the last time that Schneemann had an exhibition in London before this one, there were questions around nudity that were different from when she made Meet Joy in the first place. So, and she talked about how nudity in the 60s and 70s had a completely different meaning from nudity today, and so the work had to be altered in order to be restaged, and she didn't insist on the kind of the original meaning of nudity, the one that in a sense framed the work. Originally, she wanted the work to respond to that change, and I'm kind of interested in how that that flexibility also plays out in the difference between the photographers who took the photos that end up in Jaffrey's book and Jaffrey's relationship to those photographs, and how, in a sense, you could imagine this is just a kind of sketchy idea, really. Imagine a documentary photographer working for a newspaper who believes that what they're photographing is an image of a long, the conclusion to a long independent struggle, and that what they're photographing is this proof that one period has come to an end and another period is about to begin. This new nation is about to be born. And that's what they think they're photographing. And then 50, 70 years later, Jaffrey's looking at exactly the same image and she feels sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the meaning of that event has changed so much since it was originally photographed that you can't present it in the same way that you presented it originally.
Right. Yeah, I mean, for me, that gets to the heart of what I think, I haven't handled the book or looked through it, but what this whole project might be pointing towards, which is this idea that it is even possible to represent something with a visual document, and that is, you know, the idea that we believe that we can capture something in a photograph is an expression of the problem that produced colonialism, you know, Enlightenment thinking that the visual is superior to all other senses, and that the single point of view of the signing of the document or of the procession, a parade celebrating independence, could in fact represent that. And I think you allude to that, Dave, in your text, that actually truth is, you know, a composite of all kinds of different people's experience or documentation of a moment, and more than just a single moment. And that I think for Schneemann, there's a similar kind of idea that, you know, just the visual won't suffice. You know, it has to go through the whole body. It has to go through shared engagement between bodies. It has to go through an engagement with a material world to get to some kind of truth, that just the visual is so limited. It's part of it, but it's by no means more powerful. I mean, it's more powerful in the world that we've built post-Enlightenment, but it's not ultimately essentially better than any other way of engaging with the world. And that, you know, it made me think that, you know, there are cosmologies in these colonized places that are being completely left out by a single shot photograph, that maybe that's a different way to read this archive, is through, you know, not even against the grain, but just like, just in a different textural realm completely, you know.
I agree.
We're running out of time. I think we're going to have to end it because I think we've done
that.
But it's a great conversation. So I'm really sorry to do it. And we've had the odd Zoom glitch on the way. So I will be editing this program slightly, listeners. So if you hear a tiny break somewhere, it's a bit odd. That's why we had the classic Zoom issues. But listen, both of you, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you
again.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks, Dave.
Lovely to meet you, Ellen. Lovely to see you again, Matt.
Yeah, you too, Dave. You've been listening to the Art Monthly Talk Show on Resonance 104.4 FM. My guests today were Ellen Mara de Wachter, who discussed Carolee Schneemann's retrospective at the Barbican, and Dave Beach, who discussed Mariam Jaffrey's artist photo book, Independence Days. Hope you've enjoyed the show. We'd love you to subscribe to Art Monthly. That way you get to read all the texts. 10 times a year we produce a magazine. And if you go to our website, artmonthly.co.uk, and the buy page, you can purchase a print subscription for a mere cost of £39 for a year's subscription, or £36 for a digital subscription. Thank you so much for listening. This is Matt Hale saying goodbye.